Okay, let's talk about the book of Jude. First of all, the book of Jude is not very good reading. If you have your handout that I gave you with the 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, I think you have this one on Jude. If you don't, I'll get it for you. The author is Jude, the brother of Jesus Christ. We'll talk about this. I'm just giving you the summary. The date of the writings between 80 and 90 AD, and the theme is warning of false doctrine and false teachers. Jude writes very similarly to Peter did in 2 Peter. He writes about false prophets, false teachers. Don't let them come in. Don't let them hurt you. And his view of false teachers is slightly different than what we read in 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John, in that these Gnostics were antinomians, against the law. And they have a convoluted approach to how they come to this anti-law. Now, let me write that on the board for you. Antinomians. A-N-T-I-N-O-M-I-A-N-S. Antinomians means against law. And these individuals had a convoluted approach. I was just reading it in Barclay. Basically, what they thought was God, spirit and matter could never meet, this dualistic approach. There was spirit and there was matter, and the two of them should never meet. However, God had lots of powers, like a chain of power out there. And he called them aeons, A-E-O-N-S. Each one was like a chain. If you could picture like a power burst or a power supply, maybe a battery might be a good way to do it. And so you had God, whose spirit, then he had these little power sources that were all probably a lot more than that. Okay, but they're all linked together as God spews them forth, puts them forth. So they had a link to God, but this last one was the one that touched the earth and created the earth. And they viewed the one who created everything, created the earth, as being bad or evil. And in fact, they see the God of the Old Testament as being this A-E-O-N. This kind of evil God. The farther away the powers got from God, the more distant they became to him, the more hostile they became to him. So how they see the Old Testament, they see all the heroes of the Old Testament, as we would look at it, as evil, and all the evil people as good. So they see Balaam, Korah, the ones who rebelled, the ones who went against God, as good people, because they were actually trying to rebel for good as they saw it. So that's how they turned it all upside down. And the God of the Old Testament, oh, we don't want him, it's the God of the New Testament that we really want to serve. Now, how reminiscent, how much does that seem similar? How similar is that to the approach today? That if you don't want anything out of that Old Testament, forget about it. It's kind of forgotten. In fact, in the early days, Gideon's only gave out the New Testament. And they might have pulled the Psalms and Proverbs. I guess they thought those weren't too harmful to you. But other than that, the Old Testament was basically neglected. And most churches do not study the Old Testament. In fact, my brother Dave had a man who, one of his classmates when he was growing up, actually one of his playmates two houses away, had a son who's now going to the Church of God, some Church of God. So he knew my brother. He got on the internet, found my brother's name, found he was connected with Church of God, and thought maybe they were same group. My brother said, well, only if they worship on Sabbath would they be same group. And he said, no, they didn't. So it could have been Church of God Anderson, Indiana, Church of God, something else. Anyway, this fellow came over and visited while we were there, and his comments to Dave had to do with the Old Testament. He said he went to this church, and the guy who was teaching out of the Old Testament, like this is something new. But this friend was a Protestant. His son is the one going for the new stuff. So he kind of went and visited. He actually spoke of it like it was shocking. They did a Bible study out of the Old Testament. It's like, oh, is there something wrong with the Old Testament? But you see this whole concept that God is bad. That God who created the earth, because he touched matter. God is spirit. Spirit can't touch matter. But these forces or powers that came out from him, the more distant they became from him, the more evil they became and contrary to him. Therefore, when they created the God of creation, the one who created the earth and created humankind and created matter, he was bad. See, he's the one who touched the earth. It's a branch of Gnosticism that thinks this way too. And their view then is that any law is bad. The Old Testament law is bad and grace is supreme. They denied Jesus Christ, not like the Docetists who denied that spirit could ever come on matter, but they denied Jesus Christ by denying following what he said to do. They would not walk in his ways. What's that? The antinomians. The antinomians. Antinomians were also a branch, and I'll read that to you in a few moments. But I just want to give you that overall concept. So he's warning them of these false teachers. But these false teachers were against the law. These false teachers said immorality can reign because it really doesn't matter. After all, that was all evil anyway. So it doesn't really matter. Do what you want. You're under grace. You can't do wrong. You can't do wrong. God is in you. In fact, they even talk about pantheists. God is everywhere. God is in everything. So you can't do wrong. All right, we'll come back and we'll look at it just a little more thoroughly. I'll read you a couple quotes from it. Background then, this epistle, similar to 2 Peter 2, Jude tries to defend the basic beliefs of Christianity. Antinomians, a branch of Gnosticism, are the objects of main concern. The law was of no consequence since they were above the law in spirituality. Why did they need any of this? Especially, where was the law given? Exodus 20, where's Exodus 20 found? Ten Commandments in where? Yeah, Old Testament. Jude seems to quote from two books, two apocryphal books. One, The Assumption of Moses, verse 9, and two, the book of Enoch in verse 14. Okay, the Greek is forceful, simple, and rugged. It also, this book had a hard time making it into the New Testament canon. Why do you think that was? Well, because he really blasts these people. It's sort of a modern approach. But because he doesn't speak much about the passion of Jesus Christ. Had a hard time making it in. Please remember that after Jesus Christ died, that was such a highlight when he was resurrected, that you can read the early chapters in the book of Acts and you will find that the resurrection is spoken of often. Jesus and him, we preach him and him crucified, and we preach him and the resurrection. And the resurrection was spoken of much in the book of Acts. So they felt that any of these books that would have been written should speak a lot about what Jesus Christ went through, his sufferings, and his resurrection. And if they don't talk a lot about that, they had a hard time seeing them in the New Testament.
Why does he quote from his books?
Why does he quote from them? I don't know. You'd have to ask him, but he quotes to support what he's saying about them. Nathan?
Well, apparently the Gnostics are very big on a lot of apocryphal literature. A lot of it has comments about antinomianism and grace.
Right. Right. Good point. In other words, he's using their own literature against them. But again, I don't know why Jude did it. That's why we think Jude did it. But
if you went into the tomb like to look for Christ's body, would you be able to see it? Like, you know, you get resurrected, like your spirit, like you're resurrected in spirit, unless you're resurrected in flesh, like Lazarus or something. But if they went in there to look for Christ's body, could they have seen it?
No, Christ's body was gone.
So when Christ got resurrected, his entire body was gone.
That's gone. It's changed. When your body's changed, it'll be changed in a moment, a twinkling of an eye. It just changed.
Your flesh and blood won't be there.
No, it's changed from flesh and blood to spirit. And when it manifests, you manifest as flesh and bone. That's why when they did all the searching, they could not find, when they found the garden tomb, they took all the debris out of the garden tomb and sent it, everything they could find in there, they sent it to the labs to check it, and there was not a trace, any trace of any human remains. Now, if that tomb, which was taken a long time to hew this tomb out, I've been there, to make this and not use it is kind of stupid. You know, why would you make this, spend all this time making it for yourself and not use it? And so when they found it outside of the city, by the way, the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre, but the one outside the city, it's called the Garden Tomb. When they took everything out of that Senate, they found not a trace of any human, any type from anybody there. So that gives another strong belief that that may be the right place. And if you go there, how many have been to the Garden Tomb? Anybody? Hal, how did you feel about going there? Did you go to the Via Dolorosa? Did you go to the Holy Sepulchre? Didn't go to the, go up to it. I went right up to the one that's supposed to be, this is the area where Christ would have been done. And you have to use a very vivid imagination to picture that. With the Garden Tomb, I could see the skull, and I could also see that it was outside of the city, not in the city. And it just had, there was a field around it, the scriptures describe it. I think that was the, if any place of the two is going to be it, I think that's the place. And of course, it feels more serene when you go there. And when we, my wife and I went there, there was a lady just sitting there at the entrance crying. And I said, "Can I, you know, help you?" And she was just sobbing because of the moment of just being there. But you look inside, I mean, it was pretty awesome. If that's the place to be where your Savior was.
Did you know she was from the area, or was
she? I'm sorry.
She
was a tourist visiting the area.
It has that feeling.
I had a very serene feeling being there, but again, I probably imagine that I'm at the right place and have that same feeling. Okay, the Greek is forceful, simple, and rugged. The purpose of this book was to help individuals stick with the faith. Hang on to the faith. Don't give it up. All right, let's see. Jude is not pleasant reading. This is what the commentators say about it. Jude is not pleasant reading. It's considered, one comment made about it is that it is the stepchild of the New Testament. In other words, okay, we'll accept it, but it's not the real thing. People who are steps in a family, you know, they're the child of some other father, and then a new father comes into the home. They're the stepchild of the New Testament, not quite real. It's called Deuterocanonical. Had a hard time making it. Similar to 2 Peter, but it doesn't mean they copied from each other. The same topic could have been on both of their minds when they wrote. Let me share with you what Barclay says about this, page 194 and 197. Page 194 and 197, he identifies who might be. He says, talks about there were five Judes mentioned, and let's go to number five. This is on page 194. He's number five. There is the Judas who was the brother of Jesus. Matthew 13, verse 55, Mark 6, verse 3. If any of the New Testament Judases is the writer of this letter, it must be this one, for only he could truly be called the brother of James. This is how he opens the book, Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, the brother of James. So the only one that of the Judes that is identified as the brother of James is this one. And we know from Mark 6, 3 that James was his brother. Okay. He goes on to say, he said, if Jude, to use the form of his name which we are familiar, was the brother of Jesus, why does he not say so? Why does he identify himself as Jude the brother of James rather than Jude the brother of Jesus? It would surely be explanation enough to say that he shrank from taking so great a title of honor to himself. Also, because Jude, James, and the rest of the brothers and sisters did not accept Christ. From the scriptural accounts, did not accept Christ while he walked this earth. In fact, they were the ones who told him in John 7, well, go up, why don't you go up openly? Aren't you going to go up to the feast? He said, no. Well, why don't you go up? Well, they were trying to kill him. Their brothers were trying to send him up there, in spite of the fact he was being persecuted. Send him up, go ahead, why don't you go up to the feast? And Jesus said, you go up, I'll come up later. But they wanted him to go too. And his brothers did not believe in him, Mark 6. They did not believe in him. And if his brothers had truly been converted, what a slap in the face of them to tell John to take care of my mother. Take care of our mother, John, because these brothers are incompetent. It seems like those brothers were not of the faith at that time. But that later on, something after the resurrection, something struck them and they did become converted. Page 197, bottom of the page, it says, Jude is obviously Jewish. Its references and allusions are such that only a Jew could understand them. It is simple and unrefined. It is vivid and pictorial. It is clearly not the work of a theologian. So somebody who's just a theologian. It fits Jude, the brother of our Lord. It is attached to his name. There could be no reason for doing that unless he did, in fact, write it. It is our opinion that this little letter is actually the work of Judas, the brother of Jesus. So that's how they conclude as far as who wrote this particular book. And by tradition, it does say Jude, the brother of James, and certainly Christ's brother as well. He warns of false teachers. He warns of false teachings. And Jude tries to defend the basic beliefs of Jesus Christ. Let's look at page 183, where he describes the antinomians. Page 183 talks about the heretics. Who are the heretics from whom Jude blasts? What were their beliefs and what was their way of life? Jude never tells us. He was not a theologian, but as James Moffat says, a plain, honest leader of the church. He denounces rather than describes the heresies he attacks. So in other words, he denounces what's going on. He doesn't necessarily describe them in detail. He does not seek to argue or refute, for he writes as one who knows when round indignation is more telling than argument. In other words, he soundly denounces these individuals. But from the letter itself, we can deduce three things about these heretics. Three things. One, they were antinomians, people who believed that the moral law did not apply to them. The law did not apply to them. Antinomians have existed in every age of the church. They are people who pervert grace. Their position is that the law is dead, they are under grace. I mean, man, you're pretty strong. That's exactly a position held by many mainline Protestant churches. The law's done away. It was nailed to the cross. We're under grace. The prescriptions of the law may apply to other people, but they certainly no longer apply to them. Yeah, you can be legalists if you want to. You can be Pharisees if you want to, but it doesn't apply. Let me continue with this part in Barclay. Are you following me in Barclay, Hal? Okay. He goes on to say, they can do whatever they like. Grace is supreme. It can forgive any sin. The greater the sin, the more opportunities of grace to abound. Romans 6. Remember Paul said, what shall we do? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. And if your only definition of grace, is forgiveness, God's favor toward you in a forgiving way, that's your only definition, then the only way you get more grace is to sin more. And yet all of them are wishing them grace. May you have grace and peace. Why do they all need grace? Was Paul writing such horrible sinners? And when you go to God for grace because you're always needing forgiveness? We do need to be forgiven, yes. But is that the only reason for grace? No, grace is God's favor, his blessings. His mercy towards you, His kindness towards you, His blessings towards you. He goes on to say, the body is of no importance. What matters is the inward heart. All things belong to Christ, and therefore all things are theirs. And so for them, there is nothing forbidden. All things are Christ's. All things are mine. Therefore, anything I want to do, I can do, and it's fine. So Jude's heretics turn the grace of God into an excuse to flagrant immorality, verse 4. They even indulge in shameless, unnatural conduct as the people of Sodom did. They defile the flesh and do not consider it to be a sin, verse 8. They allow their animal instincts to rule their lives, verse 10. With their sensual ways, they are likely to wreak the love feasts of the church, verse 12. And by their own lusts that they direct, it is by their own lusts that they direct their own lives, verse 16. He gives examples of modern heresy, which I won't read much of, but just to give you this one thought, page 184. He says, talks about the ranters were pantheists and antinomians. A pantheist believes that God is everything, literally all things are Christ's, and Christ is the end of the law. They talk of Christ within them. They took no notice of the church or its ministry and belittled the scriptures. One of them, Jacob Bottomley, wrote a book entitled, The Light and Dark Sides of God, wrote, it is not safe to go to the Bible to see what others have spoken and written of the mind of God as to see what God speaks within me, and to follow the doctrine and leading of it with me. When Quaker George Fox rebuked them for their lewd practices, they said, we are God. We are God. And it goes on to talk about various other ones and basically the whole view of turning the grace of God into license. Notice page 186 and 187, background. Of the antinomianism and blatant immorality of the heretics whom Jude condemns, there is no doubt. The other two faults with which he charges them are not so obvious in their meaning. He charges them with, as the Revised Standard Version puts it, denying our only Master and Lord, Jesus Christ. They denied Jesus Christ, our only Master and Lord. And he goes on to talk about, he says, the reiteration of the word only is significant. If Jude talks about our only Master and Lord and about the only God, it is natural to assume that there must have been those who questioned the uniqueness of Jesus Christ and God. Can we trace any such line of thought in the early church? And if so, does it apply, does it fit with other evidence? And this is where we come in about this chain. And so often in the New Testament, we come in contact with this type of thought, which came to be known as Gnosticism. We know better. We know. We have the knowledge. We're elite. Its basic idea was the dualistic principle, dualistic universe. The universe has two eternal principles in it. From the beginning of time, there had always been spirit and matter. Spirit was good. Matter was not good. Evil. Out of the flawed matter, the world was created. Now God is pure spirit and therefore could not possibly have contact with matter because it was essentially evil. How then was creation brought about? Then he put out a series of these aeons, aeons or divine powers. Each of these was further from him. At the end of this long chain, this remote chain from God, there was an aeon who was able to touch matter, and it was this aeon, this distant secondary God, who actually created the world. Now, who do you think would really like you to believe that? Who is the God of this world? Small G-O-D. Who's the one who did go out and do this? But you see, he's got all this convoluted stuff out there. Some of it's true and some of it's not so true. Having gone that far, the Gnostics took another step. Of course, they talk about they were hostile. Took another step. This is the next paragraph. They identified the true God with the God of the New Testament. They identified the secondary hostile God with the God of the Old Testament. And as they saw it, God of creation was a different being from the God of revelation and redemption. Christianity, on the other hand, believes in the only God, the one God of creation, providence, and redemption. This was the Gnostic explanation of sin. It was because creation was carried out in the first place from evil matter, and again in the second place by an ignorant God, but sin and suffering existed at all, an imperfection. So therefore, we can blame God for doing this. And he goes on to talk about the ones that turn things upside down, page 188. Gnostics, therefore, so to speak, turned the Old Testament upside down, regarded its villains, its heroes as villains, and its villains as heroes. So there was a sect of the Gnostics called the Ophites because they worshipped the serpent of Edom. The Greek word for snake is Ophis, O-P-H-I-S, and there were those who regarded Cain and Korah and Balaam as great heroes. So I wanted to give you that background as we get into the book and start reading it now. Okay, let's take a look and see if there's anything else I want to deal with. The antinomians, that's something very important to keep in mind. Okay, let's go to the book of Jude. Jude verse 1. Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, and I will give you a handout, by the way, that describes, that has a whole list of descriptors on, I have it here, the characteristics of evil men. I don't know if I handed this out to you yet or not. Did I give it? Okay, I'll have this done for you, but I'll give you those descriptors as we go through. Jude, the servant of Jesus Christ, brother of James, to them that are sanctified by God. So again, he calls himself the brother of James, and which James? Well, the James who was the brother of Jesus Christ, and we can certainly go back to Mark chapter 6 and verse 3 for that explanation. He says, to them that are sanctified by God. Who's he writing to? Those who are set apart. What does it mean to sanctify? Is it anything special? No, it means to set it apart. This pen or this marker, not that one, this one. So I'm setting this apart. This is sanctified. But when you talk about sanctify spiritually, it's setting apart for a holy use. Setting apart for a holy use. Now, did you know you've been set apart for a holy use if you've been converted? You've been set apart for a holy use. And do you know that if you're a child of one of the members of the church, you have been set apart for a holy use, whether you like it or not? Now, you can choose what you want to do with that holy use, but you've been set apart. Talks about your children are holy. How are they holy? Because they're the children of someone who knows God's way of life. They can choose to do what they want with that, but they have been set apart. Set apart for a holy purpose. What's your holy purpose? To live a Christian life? To spread God's way of life to any and all you come in contact with? To be a light of God's way of life in a world of darkness? To be a beacon of light? That Christianity, God's way of life, can be lived now. Lived happily, lived joyfully, lived successfully. Not because of you or me, but because God being in us, God's strength, God's power, God's might. That's our job. And our job is to collectively and individually get the gospel out as a witness to the world. And how do we do that? Through the strength and power of God. Our example, our prayers, our work, our effort, whatever it takes to get the message out to this world of God's truth and God's way of life. So we are sanctified by God, set apart by God the Father, and preserved in Jesus Christ, and called. You who are called to be holy. The word call is K-A-L-A-E-I-N in the Greek, and it means a summoning of a man to an office, a duty, a responsibility. It's the same word. It's called to a feast or a happy occasion. It also could be called to judgment. But the word K-A-L-E-I-N, page 200 in Barclay, he gives a brief explanation about this. He actually mentions three things that we have been... see if I have it. That's in the new book, 200. He says, Christians are those who are called by God. The Greek for to call is kalein, K-A-L-E-I-N, has three great areas of use. It's the word meaning to summon a person to an office, to a duty, to responsibility. It is also used for summoning someone to a feast or a festival. It is also the word that called summoning someone to judgment. Christians are in the end to be called to the judgment seat. He also says Christians are those who are beloved of God, beloved of God. And he also shows that Christians are those who will be kept by Christ, preserved by Jesus Christ. So we are called to mercy, called to peace. He wants us to be, we are loved by God, we are preserved by Jesus Christ, and we are called. Called for a purpose, called to do a job. He says, verse 2, mercy to you and peace and love be multiplied. So may you have lots of love, may you have lots of peace, and may God constantly be there to give you mercy and strength. Verse 3, beloved, when I gave all diligence, and here we come down to the guts of this, when I gave all diligence to write to you, I really wanted to get this message out to you of the common salvation. Why is it common salvation? It's common to Jews and Gentiles. It's no longer specialized. You don't have to be a specialized ethnic group, but rather it's anyone. Common salvation. It was needful for me to write to you. I had to write to you and exhort you that you should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered to the saints. Now, if you talk about trying to practice and follow original Christianity, people think you're stupid. You don't want to be a Jew, do you? Sorry, original Christianity wasn't Jewish. I mean, it wasn't Jewish people were there, but it wasn't Judaism. Original Christianity was Christianity, followers of Christ, those who tried to emulate their Lord and Savior, walk in His ways and observe and follow His teachings. So he talks about contending for the faith which was once delivered. I'm going to share this with you because I think it's very powerful. Page 204 in New Barclay, page 179 in Old Barclay. Page 204 in New Barclay, he talks about the Christian faith, and he says this, top of the page, point number 4. He says, the Christian faith is something which must be defended. Every Christian must be its defender. If the Christian, and you know what, we all need to picture the throne of God, we all need to picture Satan the devil. And you know what Satan the devil does? He looks for a reason to accuse you. Just like my little granddaughter likes, I know that they're not allowed to make fun of each other. One of them gets in trouble or they get something or get an advantage. And so I say to them, and I tease them, I say, yeah, well, I have this, na 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 na. As soon as I say that, they run and tell my wife. He said the word. You know, he's making light over. Then my wife will come and hit me, and they love it for me to get, you know, spanked. All right. So they like to go accuse me to my wife. Okay, and I give them reason to. Satan the devil loves to accuse you to your father. You know what he likes to do? He likes to bring an evil report. He likes to go to God and say, did you see them? They're supposed to be your servant. Did you see them mess up over there big time? Do not give him reason to do that. Do you know how it hurts a father to hear how his children have messed up? And again, for their sakes, not for his sake, don't give Satan the devil any reason. Don't give him any reason at all to accuse you. Every Christian must be its defender. If the Christian tradition comes down from generation to generation, each generation must hand it on uncorrupted and undistorted, not only by pure teaching, but also pure actions. So we need to make sure we don't give Satan the devil reasons to accuse and go after us. He says the Christians must hand this on, the truth. There are times when it is difficult. The word Jude uses to defend, and he gives the word, which contains the root of the word agony. agonies, I don't have the pronunciation word here, but it's epagonizestai. Comes from the word agony. The English word comes from that. The defense of the faith may well be a costly thing. You may have to agonize to defend it. But that defense is a duty which falls on every generation of the church. So we're called to defend it. We're set apart to defend the faith. And that's exactly what he's doing. He's trying to compare. Here's how he translates verse 3. Beloved, when I was in the midst of devoting all my energy to writing to you about the faith which we all share, I felt I was compelled to write a letter to you to urge you to engage upon the struggle to defend the faith which was once and for all delivered to God's consecrated people. A lot of people can't believe, well, let's modernize the scriptures. Like God didn't know what humans were like from the time he made them. God did know what humans were like. He may not have known, chose not to know the depths to which they would sink once they had their own ways, because his remarks before the flood, it grieves me that I've made humans on this earth. Grieves me how they've become. But nonetheless, does he know what human nature is about? Does he need a course on modernism to know what human nature was about so that he can upgrade his laws? No, he knows. He knows what's good for you and me. And don't ever give Satan the devil a reason to accuse you to your Father. Don't yield to him. Don't give him that. But earnestly contend or defend the faith which was once delivered, once for all time. Delivered to the saints. So here we had they've had it, they've passed it on. Remember the analogy I gave you in my one assembly that I presented on passing on the baton. How will you pass it on? Will you pass it on pure? Will you pass it on with all types of scars and scratches and dents in it? How will you pass it on? How will you pass on that mantle? All dirty, coffee stained, or whatever else? Or will you pass it on clean to the next person? Verse 4, he goes on to say, for there are certain men crept in unawares, unbeknownst, who've come in secretly, who were before of old ordained to this condemnation. God prophesied these type of people. He prophesied about them. Now, we'll come back to that in a moment. Ungodly men, turning the grace of our God into lasciviousness. Lasciviousness is license to do whatever you please. Do as you please-ism. Now let's face it, we all like being around people that we can do as we please. You know what? If I'm around a person who's a do-as-you-please person, I feel really good. Because you know what? He's not going to judge me on anything I do. He's never going to hold me to any standard. He's never going to expect behavior of me that's anything other than what I want to do. But if I'm around a Christian, I know he has a set standard. I'm not as comfortable. Right? That's the world. If I want to do what I want to do, I'm okay, you're okay. I can do what I want, you do what you want. Hal, you want to step to the microphone? The people aren't getting our comments. I'm sorry for those of you out in tape land. And I'll say good morning to all of you too. You say good morning back, all the classes, good morning back. Okay, go ahead.
Looking at that word grace again, isn't that a license for righteousness?
What's that now, grace?
Yes.
Grace is a license
When he uses the word license for debauchery, you know, or for sin or whatever, in essence, on the opposite side, isn't it a license?
Grace should be the license for righteousness. Yeah, but grace is what you have to make up for when you slip up. Too. The grace is not an excuse to do what you want. Grace is the mercy and strength and power of God to help you through. But a good thought, a license for righteousness. But this lasciviousness, notice what it extended to, and denying the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. How do they deny him? What did they do to deny him? Well, you find in many places, Titus 1 verse 16. Titus chapter 1 and verse 16, and I'll end with this verse today. Take a little bit of time to expound it for you. Titus 1 and verse 16. We read this. They profess that they know God, but in works they deny him. In works they deny him, being abominable, disobedient, and to every good work reprobate. And of course, Luke 6, verse 46, Jesus Christ said this, "How dare you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say?" Luke 6:46, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say?" Why do you say I'm Lord, but you don't obey me? Lord means, if you call me Lord, that means you're servant. Servants do what their masters tell them. If you call me your master and Lord, you should do what I tell you. But you don't. You do what you want. But I'm really not your Lord and master, so don't call me that. That's God's sense of it. But it is interesting, the defense of the faith is something we must do. Stick with the body of belief. Stick with the foundational teachings. And be aware of these men. Jeremiah 5:31. What were these men like? Jeremiah 5 and verse 31. The prophets prophesy falsely. Here's one of the scriptures in the Old Testament that prophesies of what would be. The prophets prophesy falsely. The priests bear rule by their means, and my people love to have it so. What will you do in the end thereof? Jeremiah 5, verse 31. Jeremiah 6, verses 13 and 14. For from the least of them, even to the greatest of them, everyone is given to covetousness. From the prophet, even to the priest, everyone deals falsely. My dad basically quit going to the Eastern Orthodox Church because, and he was on their board in the previous meeting, they had brought up about this one man who was kind of a lay priest. He was doing service as an archdeacon, like a priest. And they said, since he's doing service to this other church over here, the smaller church, maybe we should give him a stipend, give him some money. So they said, yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that for him. But where are we going to get this money from? My dad said, well, what about some of the money that would come generally to the priest for going over there? And the priest was sitting there, and the priest nodded his agreement. So the next meeting they had, when they were going to finalize this, they brought up the issue and they said, now let's see, we were going to try to finance this how? Out of that priest's money. He said, oh, we don't want to take money from the priest, do we? And my dad said, well, I thought that Father so-and-so agreed to this. Didn't you, Father? He just put his head down. He left my dad standing there high and dry like my dad was trying to take his money from him when the previous time he had agreed to it. After that, my dad didn't go back to church. To that Eastern Orthodox, he had it. Why? Because this man lied. This man lied. Prophets, priests, you don't expect that from them. They lied. They deal falsely. Verse 14, they have healed also the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace. When there is no peace, everything's going to be fine. Just go off. You're going to be okay. Just pat this false security that they give, this false hope. You see people wailing at funerals because they really don't know what's going to happen. But do you think this person's going to heaven? Oh, they'll be up in heaven, rolling around heaven with these others. Excuse me, you don't know that, do you? Or they're going to be in purgatory? You don't know that either, do you? They're going to be in hell. You don't know that either, do you? That's no comfort. They try to comfort with doctrines that do not make any sense. The Bible makes sense. They're asleep. If they knew the truth, then they're going to be burned up. And if they don't know the truth, they're going to have a chance for eternal life. They're not going to suffer forever in some hellfire. The hellfire God has is a lot hotter than the hellfire of Dante's Inferno. It burns you up, and your memory is gone. So here in Jeremiah 6, verses 13 and 14, again, we find some reference to those who lie and those who pervert and those who do not teach the truth. And to be warned about it, we need to be aware. I'll give you these characteristics of Jude, of evil, that he lists in the book of Jude, how he compares them, and he compares them to many of these, quote, heroes that they thought were heroes, Cain, Balaam, Korah, because, remember, they turned the Old Testament upside down. He compares them to those individuals as to what's going to happen to them in their fate. So we'll see you on Wednesday. We'll finish up the book of Jude.